hope that the conference is going well. My name is Titus Daniels. I'm one of the representatives on the annual conference committee. So we are hopeful that the conference is going well for you and that you are enjoying all that we have to offer. I would also like to take this opportunity to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and pagers and any other devices during the presentation. And also, please make sure that you fill out evaluations after each of your sessions. We really do look at those every single year in order to inform what we will do for subsequent years for the conference. So we take those seriously and spend a lot of time going through them, so we appreciate the time that you have in completing them. This is session 2400. This is a MDR gram-negative infections across the continuum of care. We're doing a little technical setup here. This is going to be presented by Dr. Keith Kay, who's a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Department of Medicine at Wayne State University. Dr. Kay is no stranger to most people in the world of infection control. He is a prolific author and has written over 100 peer-reviewed articles, publishes in numerous textbooks, over 15, including the Hospital Epidemiology and Infection Control. He currently serving as the Corporate Medical Director of Hospital Epidemiology and Antimicrobial Stewardship at Detroit Medical Center and Wayne State University, where his primary interests are in general infection control, as well as multidrug-resistant bacteria and antimicrobial stewardship. This is obviously a hot and emerging topic, multidrug-resistant gram-negative organisms, as well as antimicrobial stewardship. And as such, this session is actually being broadcast to other international areas so that they can also participate in the content. So with that, at the end, when we have time for questions, please make sure that we do come to the microphones so that those can be recorded, not only for this session, but also for those attendees who are listening from afar. So it's my distinct pleasure and honor to be able to welcome Dr. Kay to the podium and discuss multidrug-resistant gram-negative.
Thank you very much, Titus. It's great to be back to APIC. Looking forward to talking to you all today, both for those of you who are here and those virtual listeners. We're going to talk about what I think is the most urgent, concerning issue in hospital-based infectious diseases and infection control today. And this really involves sort of heading back to the pre-antibiotic era, facing daily specters of essentially managing infections and controlling the spread of pathogens that are, in many cases, untreatable or essentially untreatable. Here are my disclosures. I'm going to give you a brief overview of multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacilli of interest that I think are of particular interest in focusing on hospital and healthcare-associated settings in general. I want to spend some time focusing on the role of long-term care in the community in the spread of multidrug-resistant gram-negatives. I want to then discuss some different strategies to control the spread of multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacilli. And finally, I want to sort of look to the future and identify both challenges and opportunities in relation to antimicrobial resistance as we move forward into the next several years. This was a landmark publication in 2009 in Clinical Infectious Diseases, where the pneumonic escape pathogens were coined. The escape pathogens essentially identify different bacteria that represent treatment challenges due to the proclivity to develop antimicrobial resistance, and they include both a potpourri of gram-positive and gram-negative organisms. Focusing on the gram-negatives, we see Klebsiella pneumoniae, which we know is an ESBL producer and also a carbapenemase producer more recently, Acinetobacter baumannii, which is one of the grand old pathogens and nosocomial infections that's always carried resistant threats, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is sort of the great-grandfather of nosocomial resistant gram-negatives, and Enterobacter. What is not on this list is E. coli, which a subsequent change from escape to ESCAPE, where the C was used for Clostridium difficile, which we know the NAP1 strain is multidrug resistant. And the E then, one of the E's was changed to Enterobacter riesiae, which then captured Enterobacter, Klebsiella, and E. coli. So I prefer, again, when you think about E, think about Enterobacteriaceae, but E. coli also now is the single most common ESBL producer worldwide. We'll talk a little bit about CTXM in a moment, and also has proclivity to develop carbapenemase production and broad-spectrum resistance. This publication not only described these challenging pathogens, but also focused and stressed the limited antimicrobial pipeline that is currently out there. There's, in terms of drugs in development, antimicrobials will show the exponential drop in antimicrobials that have been approved by the FDA over the past several years. And as a result, the pipeline is rather dry for novel agents. The antibiotics that are coming out rarely offer new activity against many of these resistant organisms, particularly the gram-negatives. And in some cases, there really are no good options and very few good options even in the antimicrobial pipeline. I think this publication also brought multidrug resistance into sort of a public health and a really national and international media type a forum, where I think it's now getting a lot more attention and a lot more urgent focus than it might have in previous years. This is just an example in 1 year, a change in use of carbapenems. This is carbapenem therapy increase from 2005 to 2006, essentially almost a 20% increase. And remember, carbapenems, back when I began training, these were, you know, in case of glass, in case of emergency, break glass and use this big gun that can treat anything. Well, now we're routinely using carbapenems, and we'll talk about the role of antimicrobial stewardship as well in resistance. But the more sort of ESBL producers we have, the more carbapenems that we're using. We use them empirically to try to impact patients who we think might be infected with an ESBL producer or with Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter. And sometimes when we actually prove that they have these pathogens, patients may remain on these carbapenems for several days. This is what I was referring to previously, a moment ago. This graph basically depicts the number of antimicrobial agents that were approved by the FDA. You can see there are four-year periods going from the mid-80s through 2007. You can see we're averaging from about four new antimicrobials a year to somewhere between zero to one new antimicrobials per year. And again, many of the antimicrobials that are now coming out may offer additional activity against things like MRSA, but rarely offer much new activity against carbapenem-resistant pathogens. I've heard the saying that, you know, we need better drugs to treat resistant gram-positives, but we need any drugs to treat resistant gram-negatives. So now we're going to focus a little bit on multidrug-resistant gram-negatives of interest. We'll start out with the ESBLs. I think these are sort of the Rodney Dangerfield in the resistance world of gram-negatives. They don't get any respect. I think ESBLs are now commonplace. They used to be a major concern, I think, when I began medical school and training. I think they have almost been forgotten about because carbapenems can treat these types of pathogens effectively, and also because we have bigger fish to fry and bigger problems, because many of these ESBL producers acquire carbapenemase or might have porn mutations and ultimately have decreased susceptibility or resistance to carbapenems. ESBLs are plasmid-mediated. They are most commonly identified in Enterobacteriaceae, so think about Klebsiella species and E. coli. And if you look at your hospital antibiogram, if you simply look at ceftazidime or ceftriaxone resistance to E. coli or Klebsiella, that will give you an idea of a rough idea of the percent of your Enterobacteriaceae that might produce ESBLs. When an organism produces ESBLs, it imparts decreased susceptibility to beta-lactam antimicrobials, and this means cephalosporins, also often decreased activity against inhibitor combinations like piperacil and tazobactam and ampicil and sulbactam. And often on this ESBL, the plasmid will all carry other genes that mediate resistance or impart resistance to other classes of antimicrobials, including aminoglycosides and fluoroquinolones. So when you have when an organism acquires an ESBL, when a plasmid that makes ESBLs, essentially, you are not just mediating resistance to your penicillins and cephalosporins, but often resistance to multiple antimicrobial classes. Back in the day, carbapenems were a great advance because they retained high-level activity against many strains of ESBLs, and these were sort of our safety net that we leaned on to help manage infections due to ESBL producers. There is currently a worldwide epidemic of ESBLs, and these are due to CTXM, which is over the past 15 to 20 years really a novel type of extended spectrum beta-lactamase, most commonly produced by E. coli, and prior to the past few years had not been reported in large numbers in the United States, had spread through many parts of Asia and Europe, but now is firmly established in the United States. Worldwide, CTXM-producing E. coli often were identified among individuals, often women in the community, with no identifiable healthcare-associated contacts. And there are many women presenting with urinary tract infections and, in some cases, urosepsis with an ESBL-producing E. coli. I'll show you in the U.S., there have been some preliminary data and some early studies that indicate this seems to be more of a healthcare-associated pathogen in the U.S., more nursing home or recent hospitalizations, and less frank community onset, or rather community-acquired type epidemiology. Obviously, with ESBLs, prior antimicrobial exposures, particularly in individuals with recurrent UTIs, can be a major risk factor. If you look at your hospital antibiogram, and if you look at your E. coli susceptibility to ceftazidime or ceftriaxone, if you looked 5 years ago, I can tell you probably would have seen about 98%, 99% susceptibility. There's a good chance that you're probably seeing closer to 90%, 92%. And essentially what we've seen both when I was at Duke and now at Troy Medical Center, their ESBL production among Klebsiella pneumoniae has remained rather flat, but E. coli has just taken off. And susceptibilities to cephalosporins are dropping. And this, at least in our institution and likely in many others, is due to CTXM production by E. coli. Why is this important? Well, the more we have to worry about ESBL production among individuals who maybe are coming from nursing homes or from the community in some instances, the more we're going to have to think about pulling the trigger on carbapenem use sooner. This is some preliminary data from the Detroit Medical Center. Over a five-year period from 2006 to 2011, the percent of E. coli that produced ESBLs increased from 2% to about 14% of all E. coli tested. We have done analysis of about 575 isolates of ESBL-producing E. coli, most from the urine, but you can see some from wounds and also 5% from blood. And you can see 85% of these were CTXM producers. So this was almost an unheard-of beta-lactamase 5 years ago is now really causing an epidemic, not just in Detroit, but in many parts of the country, leading to high rates of resistance among E. coli and really becoming the predominant type of ESBL that we'll see in many E. coli pathogens. Here are unique predictors compared to uninfected controls for CTXM-producing E. coli, include a prior history of urinary tract infection, which likely is a marker for antimicrobials, and also having a nursing home status and impaired functional status. Impaired functional status seems to be a common risk factor for many types of multi-drug resistant organisms. If you cannot care for yourself and there's more hands-on by healthcare providers and more contacts with healthcare, there's a greater risk for a spread of pathogens in a variety of settings. Also, cephalosporin exposure in our institute, this is mostly cefepime, which is one of our workhorse antimicrobials, also seem to be a unique predictor. So we're hoping to have this analyzed a little bit more intensively in the near future. This is Kayoko Hayakawa, one of my third-year fellows, who has done a great job, and we're looking forward to seeing this manuscript. But wait till after the talk, Kayoko. You don't have to leave. You're finishing now. So we're saying ESBL's big deal, right? We have the carbapenems. We don't have to worry. We can just use carbapenems. We'll start using carbapenems, and we don't have to worry about ESBLs. And it's nice, yeah, you know, Keith and his fellows can write papers about it, but it isn't going to impact us because we can treat this organism. Well, there is a nice paper that from 1998 by Rahal et al., and essentially to combat an ESBL, to combat an ESBL outbreak, they essentially changed their formulary preference. They moved away from cephalosporins, they had high rates of ESBLs, and essentially their cephalosporin utilization decreased by 80%, and they preferentially began to use imipenem. Their imipenem use during the same one-year period increased 140%. The good news, ESBL rates dropped because of the cephalosporin exposure. The bad news is that imipenem-resistant Pseudomonas increased by about 70%. There was a very large increase from essentially doubled in number. So they essentially had to move away from the carbapenem preference, used a little bit more heterogeneity. They backed off the carbapenems. They implemented more infection prevention and tightened up some of the infection prevention and overall antibiotic use, and were able to control the carbapenem resistance and to a degree the ESBL production. But simply, this is sort of the message, is that the more ESBLs that we see, and it's important to understand what's going on in your hospital with your ESBL producers and the frequency with which you're isolating them or, you know, recovering them. And also, that should tie in, maybe not directly, but there is a relationship between your broad-spectrum antibiotic use, particularly your carbapenem use. Because I think that the major problem and the major threat in hospitals and healthcare settings and with multidrug-resistant gram-negatives can be summarized with carbapenem resistance. There are some pathogens which are carbapenem resistant but remain susceptible to other beta-lactams. You might see this in Pseudomonas, where it might be ceftazidime susceptible but imipenem resistant. But more often than not, when we're talking about organisms like Pseudomonas, Acinetobacter, and Enterobacteriaceae, particularly Klebsiella species and E. coli and Enterobacter, when you have carbapenem resistance, you often have multi-drug resistance, and in some cases, pan-drug resistance. When we think about multi-drug-resistant gram-negatives and really carbapenem-resistant gram-negatives, we really think about the type of patient who is admitted from an LTAC. And I'm not saying that LTACs are bad places or that they're not run well, but these are the types of patients that are the sickest surviving patients from healthcare who remain chronically ill. LTACs admit patients from a variety of different types of healthcare centers and essentially assembling the sickest surviving individuals in a region, and they often continue to receive intensive healthcare. They often have had prior ICU exposure. They often have had prolonged hospitalizations or repeated hospitalizations, frequent indwelling devices, whether these are endotracheal tubes or central lines or urinary catheters. Thank you. And also frequent antimicrobial exposures. So as I'll show you some data, long-term acute care centers are, I think, a marker for a lot of the risk factors that go along with multi-drug-resistant gram-negatives. Many times these patients have these pathogens at the time that they arrive in the LTAC. In other instances, there might be spread within an LTAC, but clearly, these types of non-hospital reservoirs for essentially untreated organisms, I think, really raise the raise a red flag and really call for regional approaches and public health type interventions to try to coordinate care, communication, and to a degree, infection prevention and stewardship protocols across healthcare centers. When you have carbapenem resistance, you often have other resistance to all beta lactams. And frequently, quinolone resistance, often more toxic agents, sometimes immunoglycosides, and sometimes colistin, which is a polymyxin antimicrobial, which was abandoned 20, 30 years ago because it was too toxic, is now being routinely used because it's one of the only agents that retains activity against these uber-resistant gram-negative pathogens. I'm going to talk a little bit about Klebsiella pneumoniae carbapenemases, or KPCs. KPCs, again, are like plasmid-mediated, like ESBLs are, but these are plasmid-mediated carbapenemases. They were initially identified and described in Klebsiella pneumoniae. That's why they're KPCs. But when you see carbapenemase production in E. coli and sometimes in Enterobacter, it's more likely than not a KPC. So it's a little bit of a confusing term because people think Klebsiella, 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 and it usually is found in Klebsiella species, but it can be found in other types of Enterobacteriaceae and also other types of gram-negatives, including Pseudomonas, for example. Okay, the first KPC was identified in North Carolina, KPC-1, but that really didn't persist. KPC-2s and 3s became epidemic, then hyperendemic in the New York area, and spread throughout the Northeast, and then through many parts of the country and many parts of the world. There's a hyperendemic CRE challenge in New York City. In a report from a few years ago, almost 1 in 4 of their Klebsiella pneumoniae isolates, which is a common hospital pathogen, was a KPC producer. You'll hear me use the term CRE, which stands for carbapenemase-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. I like using that term more because it captures mostly KPCs, but as we'll see, there are other ways that you can develop carbapenem resistance. So I like referring, you'll hear me use the term CRE. There's a countrywide outbreak ongoing in Israel, Greece, Colombia, and others. I feel like there's probably many other places where outbreaks are going on, but their resources are not there, or the scientists or interests are not there to maybe fully or appropriately describe or quantify the problem. KPCs are tricky because much like ESBLs, in vitro, you might not see the frank resistance that these types of plasmids can impart. Often, you might see an imipenem and meropenem susceptibility based on old breakpoints, 2009 CLSI breakpoints. You might see intermediate susceptibility or, you know, an MIC of 2, sort of right at the threshold of the old breakpoints of being non-susceptible. And if you're just looking at S and you're looking for no Rs, okay, good. It's an I, but let's use a carbapenem. Essentially, much like ESBLs and cephalosporins, which might look susceptible in vitro, if you try using a carbapenem to treat a carbapenemase producer, even if there's in vitro activity, you have a high likelihood of failing, particularly in bloodstream infection, pneumonia, sort of high inoculum in infections. And as such, you can have spread of these KPCs, these KPC producers, for quite a while, and you may not recognize it until you start noticing that you're using more carbapenems when having very high failure rates with these. So you not only, if you're most of us with our panels, I think all panels are still using the automated panels, using the old CLSI breakpoints. So for imipenem or meropenem or doripenem, you might not see that high-level resistance. You might see an S or an I, but those MICs are probably going to be 2 or higher. Ertapenem, which is a type 1 carbapenem, it does not have activity against Acinetobacter or Pseudomonas, at least not appreciable activity. This generally will test resistant using old breakpoints or CLSI, the new breakpoints. The new breakpoints, which will be reflected in panels that I think some new panels in Vitech might be coming up this summer, I believe. The MICs are lowered considerably for the breakpoints. One of the reasons for doing that was to make it easier to identify KPC producers, that most of the KPC producers with new breakpoints will be resistant and not susceptible. So I'm just saying it can be a little tricky, and you don't just want to look at your R's versus S's. You may want to ask the lab for some MIC information. KPC producers are usually only susceptible to colistin, tigecycline, in some cases, and select aminoglycosides. And often, these KPC producers can rapidly spread in hospitals. There have been examples of single travelers leading to hospital-wide outbreaks in different parts of the United States and different parts of the world. So I really think that carbapenemase-producing organisms, particularly KPC producers, are an infection control emergency. I've been able to really scare administration, both at Duke and Detroit Medical Center. They actually listened to me when I warned, they got all scared. So I think it's good. This is a scary organism because it can, it's virulent, it's a virulent pathogen, Enterobacteriaceae. Think about gram-negative sepsis. These are the types of bugs that cause those infections. It can rapidly kill and rapidly spread. This is a map depicting the spread of KPC producers. I talked about North Carolina had the first KPC identified, but most of the spread through the U.S. now in 2011 has been the KPC 2s and 3s. There are some pockets that have not yet reported KPC producers, but I wouldn't be surprised if they are there as well and just haven't been totally fleshed out or confirmed. This is just showing that KPC production is not just a problem in the U.S. Many parts of the world, including Europe, Russia and the former Soviet Union, South America, are a sort of hotbeds for KPC production. This is some data from Jerome Rahayem from our institution, where we actually looked at not only did we have a KPC producing Klebsiella, these actually were colistin resistant. So these really were practically untreatable organisms. Within our health system, we essentially had five different patients who had KPC infections, and they were involving three of our three different institutions, one LTAC, an associated hospital, and essentially another hospital that was not physically attached to the LTAC. If you look at transmission opportunities, these are different units in different hospitals. The colors represent different units, and essentially there was direct crossover, at least one direct crossover between each case. So clearly, when we did the molecular work, we had essentially four of these pathogens were indistinguishable. One of the pathogens was different, was similar to an older KPC-producing Klebsiella in our institution, but clearly four of these pathogens through transmission opportunity analysis and molecular work, clearly spread through a direct horizontal spread from patient to patient. Just want to say a quick word about the New Delhi metallobeta-lactamase, or NDM1. This is another carbapenemase usually found in Klebsiella or E. coli that essentially was predominant in sort of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, has now spread throughout the world, has been isolated in the U.S., and essentially, in most instances, if you look at the antibiogram or the resistance pattern of a pathogen producing NDM1, it's going to look very similar, if not identical, to KPC producers. So you might be having NDM1s in your institution, but without doing molecular testing, you're probably not going to be able to distinguish this from KPC producers. Again, for NDM1s, individuals returning from travel, particularly having healthcare exposure, in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, which are hyper-endemic, but really I think now we might be seeing some more spread in general, even among those individuals who are not returning travelers. A word or two about Acinetobacter baumannae. This was an organism that used to live in the ICUs, then maybe ICUs in general hospitals, and now essentially, at least in Detroit, we commonly see this organism in our long-term care facilities and various hospitals of varying different sizes providing a variety of intensity of care. Acinetobacter baumannae can be fairly susceptible. Two drugs of choice are carbapenems, imipenem or meropenem or doripenem, or sulbactam. And we use ampsulbactam because that's how we can give sulbactam. Ampicillin is not active, but the sulbactam is, and resistance to both of these classes has grown. This is data from Detroit Medical Center from 2003 to 2008. The number of Acinetobacter baumannae isolates doubled from 560 to about 1,200, and our percent susceptibility to imipenem dropped from 99% susceptible to 42%, and ampsulbactam dropped from 89% to 40%. So this was my welcome present when I came from Duke to Detroit Medical Center. Essentially, our numbers have flattened out. Our susceptibility has improved a little bit to sulbactam. Still remains quite low to imipenem. These are very difficult, challenging organisms to work with when you're trying to determine what drives and the different mechanisms of resistance to these classes of antimicrobials. I don't think we can really talk about the resistance issue without talking about long-term care. For a while, we've known that a gram-negative resistance in long-term care was a growing problem. Initially, it was quinolone resistance because the quinolones were easy to give in non-hospital settings, bioavailable, you got in the urine. So things like quinolone-resistant Pseudomonas and quinolone-resistant E. coli became fairly common. There was a landmark publication by Bob Weinstein in the 1990s where he showed the spread of a single ESBL among, I think it was, five different nursing homes in the Chicago area, and this sort of heralded in the presence of ESBLs in nursing homes. I'll show you some data about Acinetobacter in a moment, which I think is one of the newer threats, at least in our region. In long-term care, again, the risk for resistant gram-negatives is going to be that declined functional status or the inability to perform your activities of daily living independently, the presence of indwelling devices, ulcers and wounds, antimicrobial exposures, and also having prior hospitalization. I don't think there's any surprises there for this group. I think those are not surprising type of risk factors. Nursing home care today isn't what it was 20 or 30 years ago. In some ways it is. It might be, you know, the place where you go and you visit grandma or grandpa and, you know, say goodbye and, you know, everything's fine. Well, that is a whole variety. It can be a residential place. It also can be a place, a short stay, where you're going there for some IV antibiotics or to, you know, get some motion back after a hip fracture. Or it can be a very high-intensity, high-acuity of care type location, like long-term acute care centers. We know some long-term care centers now provide, they're almost like complex community hospitals, providing ventilatory care. Many can give pressors at LTAC. So, again, there's a whole variety between short stay, long stay, minimal care to highly intensive, invasive care. This was a data in 2007 to 2008 from a single hospital, Detroit Medical Center. Essentially, what you see here is the number of cases of Acinetobacter baumannii that were present on admission within the first 3 days of hospitalization. And these are different long-term care facilities, 1 through 25. Blue is carbapenem susceptible Acinetobacter, and red is carbapenem resistant. You can see that during this year, 25 different skilled nursing facilities sent one or more patients who were colonized with Acinetobacter baumannii at the time that we admitted them. And in about 25 to 30% of cases, this was a carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter. So again, you can do everything right in your home, in your hospital. You can wash your hands, and you can use antibiotics right. But, you know, the more burden of infections and resistant organisms that are coming through the door, the greater the challenge is to contain the spread of these pathogens in your own hospital. This is data from Dromer Hayem. I'm going to walk you through it, so don't worry. Again, we looked at among three healthcare systems. We looked at present on admission resistant organisms, and we looked at where these individuals were coming from. So among individuals who had a resistant organism isolated in the first 72 hours, where were these individuals coming from? And essentially, what we looked at is when we looked at where they were admitted from, if you look at LTAC and skilled nursing facilities, you can see that almost two-thirds of our carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae are present on admission were coming from a long-term care type setting. And again, more than 50% of our ESBL producers present at the time of admission. And if further, if we look back at LTAC exposure in the past 6 months, remember, LTACs typically don't have huge numbers of beds, but when we did a 6 months, we went back and said, geez, these guys came in, they had carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. In the first 72 hours, almost one-third had had LTAC exposure in the prior 6 months. Again, it's not cause and effect, but I think it's more of a marker that these are challenging types of patients who can bring very nasty organisms into the hospital, coming right through your emergency room doors. This is data from Dave Sengstock, where we looked at older adults with Acinetobacter baumannii, and we looked at the degrees of antimicrobial resistance. We essentially looked at non-nosocomial community-dwelling elders here, and this is the number of antibiotic classes that Acinetobacter is resistant to. You can see about four, and in the dotted line is hospital-acquired or nosocomial Acinetobacter, and here in this tan line is a nursing home acquired, people present on admission, admitted from long-term care facilities, and you can see, not surprisingly, that the degree of resistance is a greater. Hospital and long-term care is mirror one another, sort of suggesting a healthcare-associated type risk, and in the community, a little bit more susceptible strains. Also, during this study period, during a five-year period, is about 25% increase and Acinetobacter baumannii in these older adults. This is a really nice paper by Sarah Wan et al. From Chicago. And essentially what they studied was the rapid regional spread of KPC-producing Enterobacter riesiae. And essentially what they showed using the social networking software is that one LTAC, this red dot, was linked to multiple different cases of KPCs to different hospitals, long-term care, and nursing homes. So essentially, point interventions at this LTAC would be critical and were critical. I'll show you a study that they did with an intervention. But clearly, these LTACs, because of their regional reach and the movement of patients from LTAC to hospital to long-term care to LTAC, back to hospital, back and forth, that there's great risk for spread in a variety of settings. I thought this was a really nice demonstration of this phenomena. So I know this is not the happiest talk, and I apologize. I'm not going to make it all better in the end, and we're going to say, oh, we beat them. But we are going to talk about some strategies and what we can do to control the spread of multidrug-resistant gram-negatives. We'll talk a little bit about contact precautions and hand hygiene. I think we have to talk a little bit about environment and source control, which often involves the patient and the burden of bacteria present on that patient. Antibiotic stewardship. I think it's important for infection prevention to be aware of stewardship and to help them get started because you share many common enemies. I'm not talking about administrators, maybe some of them too, but some of the pathogens really cross over into, cross over into both worlds. I'm going to talk about some Uber or enhanced infection control measures and how effective they might be. And finally, I think it's really time that we start thinking about bundling of interventions to tackle MDROs, much like we've used bundles to tackle device-related infections. So barrier precautions for multidrug-resistant organisms, do they work? I think they do work to a degree. I think most of the data for MDRO control has been, most of the published data has been in epidemics or outbreaks where contact isolation, sometimes in combination with cohorting of patients or staff, is a critical intervention to controlling the spread. For endemic spread, for just your regular old MRSA rates or your ESBL rates, it's much harder and more challenging to study. This has been studied in observational ways, but again, trying to quantify how effective contact precautions are for things like MRSA or ESBLs or KPCs, I think, is a challenge. I'm not saying they don't work. I'm just saying that we don't know if this is enough of an answer. And I always said, you know, putting the gown and gloves and signs up there isn't going to do anything. It's people complying and washing their hands, still washing their hands when they're gloving, before and after, and actually complying with these processes. This is data from Dan Morgan and Anthony Harris, where essentially they looked at individuals going in to care for a patient with MDR Acinetobacter or MDR Pseudomonas, and then they saw how contaminated their gloves or gowns were coming out. And interestingly, gloves were contaminated in more than one-third of individuals coming out of the Acinetobacter room. This is about a five-fold increase compared to only 7% in Pseudomonas. Gowns, about 10% of the time, compared to only 5% in Pseudomonas. And hands, after taking the gloves off before hand hygiene, about 5% in Acinetobacter and less than 1% in Pseudomonas. Acinetobacter gets all over the place. It's an environmental mess, and I think it's one of the organisms that I feel very strongly about the contact precautions really are important and can make a difference, particularly in outbreaks or hyper-endemic situations. I think this really is the age of the environment and infection control. We've always known about the environment, but I think we're learning a lot more about it. We're learning about environmental sources of contamination or infection and the importance of these environmental sources. If nothing else, they're reservoirs for pathogens. They're ways that healthcare workers can contaminate the hands once they're in the room, and contaminate the patient, and there might also are instances of direct acquisition of pathogens from the environment by patients. We know that the environment is particularly important in C. difficile with its spore-forming capabilities, norovirus, which can be particularly resistant to a standard quaternary ammonium cleaning, and also Acinetobacter. I think the sheer environmental density of Acinetobacter presents a challenge. I think more, I know some institutions are using bleach routinely on all rooms. I imagine we're going to move there at some point in the future if things continue with C. diff and resistant organisms. Does bleach work better for resistant pathogens? We know it works what's necessary for C. diff or norovirus. I think the jury's out on its role in MDROs, but I'll show you some bundled approaches that included bleach. Latest technology being tested are UV light and hydrogen peroxide vapor, which we'll talk a little bit about. You can buy all the fancy new UV light or hydrogen peroxide, but if you aren't actually cleaning your room, it's not going to make a whip of difference. So adequacy of cleaning of patients' rooms, I think in many institutions in the U.S., is suboptimal. I think the process of oversight and QI and monitoring often doesn't occur. I think that you need the checklist. That's there, the Joint Commission, make sure that's there. But the amount of time it's really filled out, or if a supervisor is standing in the room, someone's probably going to clean a little differently than the supervisor isn't there. I don't think that there's good. We haven't taken a lot of the other ways that we do monitoring a process, and I think we've undershot or are underservicing in environmental services. So I think if you can improve monitoring and feedback of efficacy of cleaning, that you can definitely improve performance. I think things like ATP bioluminescence and fluorescent dyes, which essentially are sort of like invisible ink that you put on different high-touch surfaces. You don't tell when you're going to do it. You don't need to do it all the time. You just do it periodically. You come back after a terminal cleaning. You use a black light, and you can light up and monitor the number of high-risk areas that were high-touch areas that were missed. You can also monitor which ones. It might be that you're always getting the toilets seem to be cleaned really well, but the doorknob to get out of the bathroom is almost never clean. The phone, the call button, the door to get out of the room, these are almost all frequently contaminated in studies. Dr. Carling has done great work by using this bioluminescence in combination with QI approaches to feedback the EVS staff and improve the efficacy of cleaning. Supplements. If you do the cleaning well and you're still having spread, or you're worried about spores or party organisms or high-level contamination that remains, and that debris and dirt is gone, UV light and hydrogen peroxide vapors are two uber or extra modalities that seem to be effective in removing spores and other hardy pathogens. It's a really nice summary by Bill Rutella and David Weber in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology from last year. If you're at all interested in everything you wanted to know about UV light and hydrogen peroxide, these are effective in vegetative bacteria and are sporicidal. The hydrogen peroxide seems to be a little bit more sporicidal than UV light. Disadvantages, obviously, cost money. It's not free. But I think the major process disadvantage is room turnover. Particularly with hydrogen peroxide, it's usually hours. You have to seal off the room. If it's you're terminally cleaning it, you can't use that room again in many cases for hours. I think the technology is getting better. There's been more, I think, process-type studies using UV light that are showing that if you time things right and work things right, you actually can use UV light and you can keep things moving with your rooms in maybe in an hour or two, or in some instances, maybe even a matter of minutes. But the big thing is these new UV light or hydrogen peroxide does not obviate cleaning. You still need to do the cleaning. A little bit about chlorhexidine. This is also the past 5 years has been, chlorhexidine has been one of the big talked about molecules in infection control and medicine. It's a broad spectrum antimicrobial disinfectant, preferred agent for skin prep prior to CVC or insertion or prior to surgery. It has been studied for source control, and that's essentially decreasing the degree of contamination or colonization with problem pathogens among hospitalized or patients in other healthcare settings. This is Sylvia Munoz-Price with Bob Weinstein. Did an intervention at one of the LTACs. I think it was one of the same ones that was in that social networking diagram, where they essentially implemented daily chlorhexidine bathing of patients in this LTAC. Their primary goal was they showed a collapse reduction of 99%. But what I was interested in is seeing what happened to the resistant pathogens in this LTAC. And you can see here Acinetobacter, Pseudomonas, and Enterobacter. made up, again, they made up almost 40% of pathogens to begin with. And during this, not only did the total number of pathogens drop, but the proportion due to these pathogens dropped to about 10 to 15%. So now there is, I think, something to be said for chlorhexidine bathing, particularly in ICU patients in hospitals. We've had a lot of anecdotal success in controlling our Acinetobacter numbers by implementing this throughout our healthcare system. I thought that this was an interesting finding. There was another study by Evans et al. In the Archives of Surgery where they implemented chlorhexidine whole body bathing specifically to look at VAP, CLABSI rates, and also colonization with MDROs. It was a multifaceted primary objective. Essentially what they showed, in terms of MRSA, they had about a threefold reduction in MRSA. Acinetobacter, their numbers started out small. They did drop from about 5% of isolates to about 1%. Not statistically significant, but still interesting. But clearly, chlorhexidine is active not only against gram-negatives, but also against gram-positives, including VRE and MRSA. They also had a drop in CLABSI. I think clearly the data is strongest for chlorhexidine and central line-associated bloodstream infection, but also I think there's a potential role in source control and antimicrobial resistance. So antimicrobial stewardship is here to stay. There was a nice paper from APIC that described the role of infection prevention in antimicrobial stewardship. I think in the days 5 or 10 years ago, whenever there was joint commission, they would talk to the infection control people and say, what's your outpatient antibiotic use like? And you'd be like, I have absolutely no idea. You're talking to the wrong person. So, I mean, I don't think our role is to know that sort of information. That's where I think stewardship is playing a bigger role. But, you know, we do the surveillance, and we know when there's an increase in resistance. We know when there may be breakdowns. There's more surgical site infections. There's something going on with preoperative antibiotics. So I think communication, providing surveillance data, and helping stewardship individuals get started in the quality process and navigating the landmines of the administrative landscape can be critically helpful. So I think there's a big role. But clearly, antibiotic use, particularly for gram-negatives, there's a very much direct role to selective antimicrobial pressure. Certain antibiotic overuse clearly leads to more ESBLs or carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter. And I think it's clearly been demonstrated the combination of infection prevention and antimicrobial stewardship can have a great impact on multi-drug resistance. So stewardship is only going to grow. I imagine it at some point it's going to be part of a formal part of national patient safety goals or joint commission. So I think there's huge opportunities for synergy and cooperation between the stewardship folks and infection prevention and control. Enhanced infection control processes, active surveillance, you know, looking for the bottom of the iceberg, essentially screening individuals for looking for asymptomatic colonization. The goal is to identify patients who are carriers of resistant pathogens, silent carriers, so that you can isolate them or do other interventions to prevent spread to others. I have a whole talk specifically on active surveillance. Most of the literature is in the gram-positive world, particularly for MRSA. I think there has been a lot of successes with active surveillance. I think that there have also been some issues where active surveillance didn't have the great impact that we thought that it would. I think for gram-negatives, we know even less. Acinetobacter, routine culturing, perirectal culturing, et cetera, very low sensitivity. Things like carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae were actually better with standard culture or, in some cases, PCR. You can have a sensitivity above 75%. There's also cohorting of infected patients, also dedicating staff to patients. If you're cohorting individuals, you may essentially cohort your staff as well to care for those individuals. So this leads me, there's stewardship, there's standard infection control, there's enhanced infection control, there's environmental control. I think we really need to think about bundles. Remember that bundles are grouping typically evidence-based interventions that, when practiced together, have a synergistic effect, a greater impact, and more bang for your buck than practicing one, two, or three of the components together. We've had wonderful experiences with bundles and things like CLABSI and CAUTI. Carly Muto at Pittsburgh also looked at this for C. difficile. And I think the time has come. We're already seeing some studies that are doing this for resistant organisms. This is a really nice study by Yuda Carmeli's group in Israel, where essentially they had a countrywide outbreak of carbapenem-resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae. They now have sort of an Israeli CDC, but at the time they didn't. And they sort of were at a meeting and started talking, and they all had these huge increases in KPC-producing Klebsiella at about the same time. They coordinated a task force, and they did a multifaceted intervention, which included active surveillance screening, initially with culture and then PCR for KPC carriage at the time of admission, contact precautions, and they cohorted colonized or infected KPC carriers and also dedicated staff to those individuals. Essentially, what Dr. Carmeli demonstrated is that during the peak of the epidemic, they launched their intervention, and they had about a five-fold decrease in KPC producers' acquisition in the hospital, and this has been maintained over several years. And you'd have some really nice data that when there were breakdowns or on weekends when they didn't screen someone and they wanted the general population, that they've had instances where a single patient who should have been screened and caught wasn't, led to sort of 10 to 15 additional cases over a two-week period. So this has been very effective, and sometimes the breakdowns where you make a mistake demonstrate just how effective this practice was. APIC has a nice guide to the elimination of multidrug-resistant Acinetobacter. They really go through all the different strategies and a lot of the literature. Obviously, they focus on surveillance and epidemiology, and they also point out that active surveillance and screening cultures, unlike for CRE or KPC producers, is of limited use because of poor sensitivity. Jeromar Haim did a study where they cultured multiple sites of patients with known Acinetobacter infection, and only, even with five sites culturing, only 55% sensitivity. There are some preliminary publications that use the special media and skin sponge sponges on the skin that have higher sensitivity rates, but those I have not, I'm not familiar with, and I think those are at a single institution currently. This was a very nice study in Thailand with Vicky Fraser as a senior author, where they essentially had pan-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii, like many of the strains we're seeing now. They had huge outbreaks in an intensive care unit. They enhanced infection control precautions. They did use active surveillance. If you're going to use active surveillance for Acinetobacter baumannii on intubated patients, clearly tracheal secretions or deep suctioning will give you the most bang for your buck. It's a common place for Acinetobacter to live in the respiratory tract. They also cohorted infected and colonized patients, and they also used bleach for environmental cleaning. They, instead of their quaternary, in addition to quaternary ammonium, they were also bleaching. And essentially what they showed is in their three different ICUs, they essentially had about a 2 to 3-fold decrease in Acinetobacter baumannii acquisition and spread, and this persisted over a several-month period. So, you know, while we don't have all the answers, I think there's some things that we know. We know that multidrug-resistant gram-negatives are growing in prevalence. They're not just growing in the hospital. They're growing in other sort of long-term care settings. And there's the possibility that they might even be spreading in the community in terms of CTXM producers. Certainly in other parts of the world, the community is a major player. Antimicrobial stewardship is a critical component that can complement the efforts of infection prevention. There are many win-win opportunities, and I think multidrug-resistant gram-negatives are one of those opportunities that you can really get much more juice from the squeeze if you combine efforts. The problem with multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacilli, these problems are accentuated by the dry pharmaceutical pipeline. Novel methods to control spread of MDROs, like active surveillance, also using UV light or hydrogen peroxide, are attractive and kind of cool, but I don't think have been clearly demonstrated to be effective or cost-effective. Certainly in endemic settings have not been demonstrated yet. I think the good news in infection control is that technology is definitely catching up with us or surpassing us. I think the challenge for us, particularly in the environmental hygiene and rapid diagnostics, is to know which type of technology to invest in and which we're going to get the most benefit from. And remember, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but technology and protocols alone don't do anything. It's the process behind those technology and protocols. And too often I see new rapid diagnostics in the micro lab, but you haven't figured out how to notify the infection control or the physician, so there's no impact. Also, again, contact precautions and hand hygiene, having policies is great, but if you're not compliant, your healthcare workers are not compliant, obviously there's no effect there. I think we can safely say that no single process is completely effective in limiting the spread of multidrug-resistant gram-negatives, at least none that I'm convinced that you can do one thing and everything will go away. I think bundled interventions have been successful in other areas, and I gave you some examples, particularly in outbreak settings. I think we frequently use bundled interventions, but I think the time has come for sort of endemic multidrug-resistant organism bundles. I think the other major theme is that antimicrobial resistance, and the focus here has been the gram-negatives, is really a regional issue. We're not operating on islands or icebergs or silos. We're very much, there's a huge movement of patients around healthcare settings. There's often interchange of healthcare workers who may work in one area in a weekend, a different place during the week. So I think we need some regional approaches, and if nothing else, better communication about threatening pathogens and, you know, more collaborative work. And it sounds great. Obviously, it's a lot of work, and there has to be a lot of willing parties who want to collaborate on these types of efforts. So that's all that I wanted to say, and I thank you for your attention. We can take any questions now. There are two microphones.
While people are making their way to the microphone, great talk. Thank you very much for coming and giving us that. You mentioned the LTAC as being a marker for MDR. So practically in your facility or across your system, do you empirically isolate patients that are coming from long-term?
So we will, individuals coming from long-term acute care centers or who've had exposure in the past 6 months, which we do our best to try to ascertain that, we will isolate and we will do screening. We'll do rectal or perirectal culturing. And if they return negative, they'll come off contact precautions. And we'll look for CRE, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. Question?
Yes, thank you. The question is about bleach disinfection. There's a really nice poster presentation, and it's about how they use bleach in their institution, and it decreased their rate of C. diff. But what they found was, and they're still investigating this, they're going to be looking at this further, they found that the rate of acinetor actually increased. So my question to you is there anything about some type of resistance to disinfectants?
So the question was about bleach and potentially increases in Acinetobacter baumannii, as was described by one poster today. Not that I'm aware of. Bleach really... some types of bleach aren't necessarily a cleaning. They're in addition to the routine cleaning, so you can't just forget about your typical cleaning agents. But bleach is very active, so I'm not aware of that. And again, Acinetobacter is one of those pathogens that can come in waves and go in waves. So I certainly, if I continued to bleach, I would want to keep an eye on the Acinetobacter, because I think, you know, it might come back down again. Chlorhexidine, Acinetobacter has a little bit of an increase. It can be more resistant to chlorhexidine than some of the other pathogens, but at least in vitro. But we've had a lot of success with eliminating Acinetobacter. So, no, I'm not aware of any bleach issues with Acinetobacter or other gram-negatives.
Okay. So, basically, in terms of any organisms, as far as you know, there's no evidence of any type of resistance to disinfectants.
In terms of our typical quaternary ammoniums or bleach, I mean, there's some intrinsic resistance among some of the hardier viruses like norovirus and among spores. But no, I'm not, I mean, I'm sure that there are instances where things are resistant, but I think it's very unusual and not commonly identified.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes?
My question deals with the CLSI new breakpoints and the modified Hodge test. In that, with the old breakpoints, they're missing the carbapenemase producing organisms, but with the lowered breakpoints, they're catching these. How often are you coming across organisms that are actually sensitive to carbapenem, but they're linked in this group, this net, that they're showing carbapenem.
So the question, I think, to summarize the key components, the question was about having carbapenem susceptible enterobacteriaceae that actually produce KPCs or carbapenemases. How often will that happen based, even after they change the breakpoints? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm asking, with the new breakpoints, how many of those organisms are actually sensitive to carbapenem, but they're being looked at as...
Right, so, you know, I think they're changing the breakpoints, so they're not going to be considered susceptible anymore. So, you know, if it's an MIC of 2 now, and, you know, the breakpoints are going to be less than 1, I believe. So, you know, essentially what you're going to see now, the KPC producers and carbapenemase producers, the great majority are going to be captured just by showing as resistant once the new breakpoints are implemented. And I think it's going to exclude pretty much, to a large degree, the likelihood of carbapenemase production by going by resistant versus susceptible in the new breakpoints.
Okay.
I'm not answering your question, though.
No, I'll ask you.
Okay, thanks.
I'm just curious, if your area, if you are seeing a lot of CRE resistance, what are you using empirically for patients coming from LTACs through your ER that are going to go into your ICUs?
So the question was, for patients who are high risk, maybe for CRE, who are sick, what are you using for empiric therapy? Well, you know, the levels of CREs in our health system have not reached the point where we'll empirically give colistin, and colistin is not a benign drug, so it has toxicities. We are currently developing a risk model to differentiate ESBLs versus KPCs to decide who we should treat empirically. But we'll often use combination therapy, and I think a lot of times if you're using a carbapenem or another anti-pseudomonal in combination with possibly an aminoglycoside,
yeah,
frequently,
yeah,
aminoglycosides will have some activity against many of these CREs. I know there are some places in New York that are hyper-endemic for resistant Acinetobacter and CRE, where, you know, they'll often be using for healthcare-associated or ventilator-associated pneumonia, you know, colistin plus tigecycline might be an empiric therapy. We haven't reached that point yet, but I do think combination therapy certainly will increase the likelihood of getting some activity with one of the agents. And I think aminoglycosides, largely because they've been underutilized, have retained good activity against many of these pathogens.
Thank you.
Yes.
I know that we have a couple of more people having questions. I know Dr. Kay will stay and answer those. We're a little over time. We'd like to just, again, acknowledge that this session was broadcast globally by Weber Training. So we want to thank all those participants for joining us. And that concludes this session. We'll take additional questions afterwards. Thank you, Dr. Kay, for a great session.